Good evening. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday night, August 5th, 2020, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. In about 5 minutes on Ozarks, Antoinette Grajeda reports on a nearly $2 million grant that will help residents in the city of Ozark have better access to broadband. And later, Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich examines best practices for mask wearing to keep us all safe as we continue to navigate through the pandemic. Tomorrow afternoon on Here and Now on 91.3, we'll hear the latest from Washington on negotiations over the next relief bill. And 75 years ago, President Truman deployed the first of two atomic bombs that eventually ended World War II. But those bombs killed tens of thousands of people in Japan. What's the legacy of atomic weapons? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston, beginning tomorrow afternoon at 1, right after the Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large. Arkansas's new cases of COVID-19 increased by 912 during the last 24-hour monitoring period. That includes 754 community cases. Governor Asa Hutchinson delivered the latest numbers at his daily press briefing in Little Rock. He says there are 158 new cases in correctional facilities in Arkansas, most of those at the Delta Regional Unit in Chico County. The governor says the state is planning to give each inmate in Arkansas's 19 correctional facilities a COVID-19 test.
At this point, 10 have already been fully tested. All the inmates in 10 of the facilities have been tested, including the Delta unit, and that's one of the reasons that we discovered additional positive cases there through, we call it mass testing, but it is 100% testing of the inmates in those facilities. So we have 9 more to do. Our goal is to have 100% of our inmates tested by the end of this month.
Pulaski County reported the most new community cases, 79, and Sebastian County again had the second highest number of new cases, 51. There are 40 new cases being reported in Washington County and 20 new cases in Benton County. In all, a dozen Arkansas counties reported 20 or more new cases. Another 18 deaths from the virus have been reported in the past 24-hour monitoring period. And since the pandemic began, 508 Arkansans have died from coronavirus. There are 516 Arkansans hospitalized because of the virus. That's 10 fewer people than yesterday. And as promised yesterday, Johnny Key, Arkansas's Secretary of Education, was at today's briefing. He says the state has opened a call resource center for parents and teachers to access information about education and schools.
We will take this opportunity to either get the resources they need or direct them to the right place. This is something very important as we get closer to the start of school, that parents are going to have more questions. Obviously, many of those questions will be dependent upon the work that's happening in their local school districts, but we will work to make sure that we get those answers for them. It's also important that we provide this resource to all Arkansans, and that's why I'm very proud of the partnerships that we have here. We are partnering in this endeavor with UAMS, with the Arkansas Department of Health, with Arkansas Children's Hospital, the Republic of the Marshall Islands Consulate, the Arkansas Bilingual Bicultural Education Support Network, and the Office of Coordinated Support and Service.
Secretary Key says the call center is open from 8 until 4, Monday through Friday. The number is 833-353-6050. He says if the number of calls is high, the hours for the call center might be expanded. Governor Hutchinson says the Arkansas Department of Health has put new directives and guidelines for school-sponsored music, band, and choral activities online. This as the scheduled first day of school in Arkansas, August 24th, gets near. And Dr. Greg Bledsoe, Arkansas's Surgeon General and the chair of the Advisory Committee on High School Sports, spoke at today's briefing. He says the second meeting of that advisory group took place today.
So we've had a lot of perspective shared and a lot of great discussion. I mean, obviously, we are still in the middle of a pandemic, and our focus is going to be on mitigating the risk of the spread of COVID-19 and making sure that we can have when they begin in the fall. But along with that, we also recognize that sports and other extracurricular activities are a big deal. It's not just about fun. It's about students and athletes participating in activities that could open up opportunities for them later, rubbing shoulders with mentors such as coaches and other activity leaders who can have a tremendous impact on their lives.
Governor Hutchinson says the advisory group will provide suggestions to him this week so he can make further decisions regarding fall sports, like football, at the state schools. As of now, those fall sports are to be played as scheduled. Also today, the governor announced he's selecting Dr. Jose Romero, the acting Secretary of Health for the state, to become the permanent secretary. This after Dr. Nate Smith left the position for a job with the CDC.
It will be a tough act to follow. It will be for Dr. Nate Smith, and we have a very illustrious number of secretaries of health that have served in this position in the past. So I will strive to meet that expectation.
You can keep up with developments related to COVID-19 at our COVID-19 page at KUAF.com. And Oklahoma's State Department of Health is now reporting 583 deaths in that state from the virus, with 645 Oklahomans currently hospitalized because of COVID-19. This is Ozarks at Large. A nearly $2 million Arkansas Rural Connect broadband grant is helping improve broadband access in the city of Ozark. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
The $1.9 million grant is being awarded to the city in partnership with Pinnacle Telecom to deploy fiber to homes. Pinnacle Telecom serves portions of western Arkansas and eastern Oklahoma. Drake Smith, Senior Manager, Director of Sales for Pinnacle Telecom and Pinnacle Communications, says his company is already providing high-speed internet to local businesses in Ozark.
We deployed fiber in Ozark, Arkansas in 2017 along the business corridor, with plans at some point in the future to be able to extend, hopefully, to the residential side. Well, obviously, when COVID hit, people went home, schools lit out. And so you have all these students out there that can't do their work from home because they don't have a good enough internet connection.
The goal of the Arkansas Rural Connect program is to provide high-speed broadband to rural communities throughout the state, as outlined in the state broadband plan, which Governor Asa Hutchinson released last year. The Arkansas Department of Commerce received $19.3 million in CARES Act funding for ARC grants after getting approval from the CARES Act Steering Committee and the Arkansas Legislature. Grant recipients must expend their funds by December 30th. An additional $4.7 million is available in state funds for projects that would extend beyond December 30th. So far, Fairfield Bay, Lowenoak, and Ozark have been named grant recipients. Fairfield Bay and Lowenoak have been awarded $1.5 million and $2 million, respectively, for their projects. Smith says when applying for the grant, they had to prove Ozark was an underserved community.
Well, if you look at a map, a distribution map of existing providers, and they will dictate, hey, we've got good broadband connectivity here. People are not underserved here. And so the map of Ozark showed that they were already served adequately. So we actually had to do sample broadband tests throughout the community of Ozark to prove that that they didn't have adequate bandwidth.
Per the program guidelines, Smith says they're required to have everything built out by the end of the year.
That's a monumental task, by the way. Normally, a build of this size, we would take a year and a half to do, with 6 months of engineering and a year of a build out. But this will actually provide fiber to the door to around 800 homes. Those that sign up for it, it'll be eligible for around 800 homes. Now, that doesn't mean there's going to be a 100% take rate, but those are within the program guidelines and the map that we filled out, it's going to cover around 800 homes, and it's a true fiber-to-the-door solution.
Smith says he expects Pinnacle Telecom to launch marketing efforts in September to inform Ozark residents about the service and help sign up those that are interested.
So there'll be a telephone number that people can call that will be specifically for this Rural Connect program to sign up for it. We'll have a special landing page on our website that they'll be able to go and sign up for. And then also, of course, direct sales. So we'll actually have people on the ground going door to door, advising and explaining what the program means and signing up people that way.
Although the service won't be ready in time for the scheduled start of the school year later this month, the response from Ozark residents indicates there's still a need for the service.
I tell you, the reception has been fantastic by the business community when we deployed there, and now by the city officials that being able to provide a true internet solution for the residents. We've had tons of calls already. So everybody's very, very excited about it. Between now and the end of the year, you know, the question is, well, what do we do, right? Well, you're going to have to do what you've been doing, which is just relying on a slow internet connection, limp through it to the end of the year, and then we'll have a solution for you.
More information is available at pinnacletelecom.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
After a two-month wait, the city of Fayetteville now has federal money to help its residents and local agencies during the pandemic. Yolanda Fields, the city's community resources director, says late last month, the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development finally released the more than $430,000 in CARES Act funding that a lot of people have been waiting for.
I was getting calls from individuals saying, as soon as your program is available, please let us know. I was getting calls from agencies. I was getting calls from individuals working with groups at U of A and different other community groups saying, as soon as that funding's available, because everybody was aware that we were waiting to have access to the funding.
Field says the majority of the funding, about $238,000, has been put toward the city's rent and utility bill assistance program for Fayetteville residents who are having a hard time making ends meet during the COVID-19 outbreak.
Whether it be that they lost their employment or they had reduced hours or whatever, or in some cases their expenditures went up because kids are now at home. And so maybe where meals were being covered through school or whatnot, they're seeing a desperate need. So they're having to choose, do I spend money to feed my kids, to pay my utility bills, or to pay my rent?
There has also been an increase in residents who need assistance feeding their pets, which Field says the city can help with through its Rangers Pantry program.
We also are doing Animeals, which is we deliver a month's worth of pet food to seniors on Meals on Wheels. So we've seen an increase in the number of folks that are utilizing that program. So it's obvious to us that there is a need.
The rest of the CARES Act funding, nearly $198,000, has been distributed among seven agencies that provide services to those in need. Field says that includes the Boys and Girls Club, Magdalen Serenity House, Seeds That Feed, St. James Methodist Church, Welcome Health, Peace at Home Family Shelter, and the Seven Hills Homeless Center.
Seven Hills will be setting up a temporary homeless camp over behind their Walker residential area, where they will be providing a place for folks to stay. They will be providing food. They will be providing supplies and case management.
Field says any Fayetteville residents who are having difficulties paying all or some of their rent or utilities should contact the Community Resources Division to fill out an application for assistance. We've put that information on our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Washington Regional's Her Health Clinic provides comprehensive care for women of all ages, including gynecological exams, prenatal care and deliveries, infertility treatments, and women's primary care services. Located in Washington Regional's Women and Infant Center, Fayetteville, and the Springdale Center for Health in Harbor Meadows. WRegional.com for more.
Good Wednesday. This is Ozarks at Large. Expert opinions on the use of face coverings have evolved since the COVID-19 pandemic was declared in the United States in March. Initially, Americans were advised masks were not necessary, and only first responders and medical providers required them. With more states now mandating masks to bar the spread of the virus, just how many Arkansans are wearing them, and what prompts a person to do so, and which face coverings provide the best protection? Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich explains.
No hard data yet exists on just how many Arkansans are wearing masks when out in public, says Mark Williams, dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences in Little Rock.
And it would be terribly difficult, I think, to get a reliable and valid number on how many Arkansans are social distancing or not wearing masks, simply because of response bias.
Survey bias is a tendency to answer questions on a survey not based on truth, but on socially acceptable behavior. But Williams believes since Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson issued a mask mandate in mid-July, more Arkansans are wearing masks.
Just from my own personal observation and the observations of others who have been noticing is that is since the governor implemented the mask policy, there has been a noticeable increase in the number of people wearing masks, at least here in Little Rock where I live.
UAMS researchers in mid-July forecast as many as 40,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases in Arkansas by early August. We've crossed that threshold. UAMS is also reporting that that case count could fall if at least half the population wore masks.
Although there's not been good research done on this, it may require a higher number of people wearing masks to have a mitigation effect, simply because the number of people who are infected is larger.
Which includes both symptomatic and asymptomatic Arkansans, he says. The question is, what prompts an individual to take the initiative to wear a mask?
Well, first off, I think there would need to be some sort of perception on the part of the person that there is a risk. And again, with as it's been said many times before, with masks, we're really not, we're reducing, but we're not eliminating the chances that we ourselves can become infected. What we're really having an impact on is the chance that someone else can be infected.
And Arkansans willing to comply with the mandate are having to decide what sorts of masks to wear. Kier Vias, MD, an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Disease, also serves as medical director for infection prevention at UAMS. First, he says, cloth masks don't really protect against inhaling virus particles, which is why social distancing is so important.
But they are really good at preventing people from expelling. So if we cough or sneeze, the droplets that come out of our nose and mouth, if we are wearing a cloth mask, most of those particles are caught.
Vias says cloth masks should be tightly woven cotton with multiple layers.
They should cover your mouth and your nose. Sometimes people have a tendency to let them slip down below their nose, and that doesn't filter all of the particles that we may be breathing out. And so it's important to make sure that the mask fits appropriately.
No gaps around the nose or jaws.
There are lots of different kinds, lots of different shapes. Some of them kind of have a little peak that goes up over the nose. Some of them have little metal nose pieces that can be formed to your face to give a little bit better fit. You know, most of the kinds that we see now have the ear loops to keep them in place. Some others tie at the back of the head. Any of those are fine as long as they provide a good fit and they stay in place.
Vias says cloth masks require routine laundering. Masks that have side vents, for example, used in construction, are not suitable. As for healthcare workers,
the workers are in close proximity to people who may be sick. We use traditionally they're 3-ply, but they're medical grade masks.
The pleated thin blue and white masks with ear loops were in short supply but are more plentiful now, available for purchase at local pharmacies. They can be reused, VF says, if kept clean and dry. But he warns that one mask should be avoided by the public. N95 masks, they're expensive, require fit testing, and are critically needed by medical workers.
These are very special pieces of equipment, and they have to meet very strict standards for the level of filtration that they provide. Our primary function is to filter the air that the wearer is inhaling so that any infectious agents aren't inhaled in.
NPR reported last month that nearly 80% of imported disposable blue surgical masks are being shipped from South Korea or China to the U.S. to meet both public and medical demand, with pre-market regulatory clearance waived due to the pandemic.
That unfortunately, there are counterfeit products out there. For most masks, even kind of medical or healthcare masks, there are certification standards, but really it's for the standard mask, it's to protect droplets, and that's a pretty straightforward function that most masks are going to be able to accomplish.
To be safe, purchase or sew a set of tight-fitting, multi-layered, washable cloth masks. So what if a majority of Arkansans don't start wearing masks? Again, Mark Williams with UAMS.
What people sometimes don't understand is that this epidemic can get completely out of control. And it can reach a point where it's not just jeopardizing the hospital systems within the state, but it's jeopardizing the public health system itself. That our public health system at that point will be unable to really control the virus.
In the U.S., according to CDC, over 150,000 Americans have died from COVID-19, with over 4.5 million positive cases. The CDC also reports that 50% of patients infected exhibit prolonged side effects: fever, cough, shortness of breath, chills, muscle soreness, headache, fatigue, skin rashes, vomiting, and stomach pain. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. Appleseeds is collaborating with Chef Brooks Cameron to build gourmet Mediterranean picnic baskets you can enjoy at Gully Park, or get them to go and then head to the destination of your choice. Picnic baskets will be available for pickup at Appleseeds in Gully Park between 5:30 and 6 p.m. tomorrow. Along with the meal, Appleseeds will provide a selection of fun yard games such as spike ball, can jam, badminton, and others that you're invited to use during your time in the park. If you'd like to know more, appleseedsnwa.org. Can jam, C-A-N, space, J-A-M. No idea what can jam is? We'll have to go find out. You can find out what you missed on Ozarks at Large each day by subscribing to our free Ozarks at Large newsletter. It drops into your email box every Monday through Friday and provides links to every story and interview that you might want to listen to. Just subscribe at KUAF.com. Staying safe and staying entertained these days doesn't always mean being able to be out and about. But pack a lunch, put some gas in the car, and you can spend a day taking in public art all across the region. The Unexpected in Fort Smith has several years' worth of murals to inspect. There are murals in neon scattered about Bentonville, murals in Rogers, and the city of Fayetteville has added several murals in just the past few months. A collection of artists created No Justice, No Peace at the corner of College and Dixon in Fayetteville. Phoenix Gallery boasts an eye-popping work on the Fayetteville Square, and the delayed but now completed first-ever Sprayetteville Street Art Festival has added 9 new murals in 8 locations created by 11 artists all around town. The festival was scheduled to start in April, but the virus paused activities. Now, though, the murals can be seen, and last week we met an organizer of the festival, Renaga Farbiage, and one of the artists involved, Jason Jones, below Jason's mural on the side of the Dixon Street Bookshop in downtown Fayetteville. We were masked well more than 6 feet apart when we talked. We asked Jason about his mural. It's a laser gun shooting out energy and bees. First, though, we asked Renaga about orchestrating such an undertaking during a pandemic.
We had all of our artists, all of our walls pretty well locked down, which we were told by Jason and others in the know that would be the most difficult thing to do. And then right at the beginning of March, everything kind of locked down, and we just shut everything down and figured that we'd wait and see what happened. And it took about 2 months, about toward the end of May, we started to look at it and realize that it was just too important not to do, you know, with people being homebound and just not a lot of things to do outside. We thought Spradeville would be the perfect social distancing art event to be able to enjoy something outdoors, you know, watch the artists create, which is really what a mural festival, part of what a mural festival is all about, is watching the artists create the pieces, and be able to social distance and have, you know, have a point to, a reason to get out, you know, and enjoy the Arkansas spring and, well, as it turned out, Arkansas summer. Fortunately, it was kind of really hot, which I felt bad for the artists. But it was either a matter of that or pretty much cancel it and wait till next year, and we just didn't want to do that.
And we're standing below your work. First of all, does it have a title?
I typically don't title my work. I've kind of learned, you know, whenever I do pieces, I kind of have an idea and a theme and meaning behind it, but I've learned to let other people come up with, they come up with way better concepts behind things than I do a lot of times. So yeah, I didn't really title it.
So you've got one of the best walls in Fayetteville. It's on the side of the Fayetteville, the Dixon Street Bookstore. And it's a long rectangular wall that you can see coming down Dixon Street. What was your inspiration and how did you make it happen?
Well, originally with the 420, kind of the theme they originally had was health and wellness. So I based my concept kind of loosely around that, which this was a sketch I had worked with some before, kind of a mesh up of nature and technology. So this kind of merged with that kind of wellness idea, where I took the ray gun that I painted as a sort of a symbol of future technology and it being compatible or helping nature, and opposed to most technology kind of ultimately does harm to nature. So it was kind of my spin off of that as being health and wellness and taking care of the earth.
You know, I've told you this before, one thing I love about your murals is that you can step back and see the whole thing, or you get up close and you start seeing the details. I love the bees.
Yeah, I definitely like, I want it to look nice from a distance, but I always try to put something small in there that will draw people in and notice some little details in there. And I think the bees do that. They're like a little element, you know, you'll spot if you get out of your car and walk up to it. So nice little surprise.
Nine murals, actually. Eight locations. We had two artists collaborating on two of the locations. The Dixon Street Bookstore, Jason Jones was on one side, and Jessica Jones, no relation, but it was kind of fun that we kind of called them JJQ squared, on the other side of Dixon Street. And then out at Free Geek, which is out by Fossil Cove Brewery, we had two Little Rock artists, Eats and Chemex, collaborated on the biggest wall in Spradeville, and it's an amazing wall. It's a mashup of kids from their neighborhoods, of all, you know, ages, races, just a beautiful celebration of diversity and life. And then the other murals are Gearhead Outfitters, Grubbs, Be Unlimited, Washerama, 26 West Center, right on Block Street and off the square, and the Skadium. Just a really diverse and fantastic collection of art, new art for, you know, Fayettevillians to enjoy. I particularly want to mention Tommy Tropical's mural, Starlight Landscape. It's a 200-foot wall. It's 10 foot at one end and 5 foot at another, but it's like walking through a storybook. It's just a fantastic mural to enjoy with family. You can literally walk from one end, and there's just so many great creatures and figures in it. You know, tons of Instagram selfie spots, and I mean, all the murals are great shots for Instagram. So,
what responsibility do you feel when you hit, which is more or less a public wall? I mean, this is a wall owned by a business, but it's a wall that's seen by everybody. Do you think about that?
I do. I mean, of course, you know, you're really vulnerable when you're kind of doing this, putting yourself out there on a grand scale. You don't know what's going to happen on social media or what people are going to think or that. I always just kind of focus on the kids. I want to, you know, that's kind of a starting point for me. I think whimsical and like, what are the kids, you know, what's going to inspire a kid? I don't always make all the adults happy, but most of the kids I run into are like, that's cool. Yeah. So I just kind of run with that. And in the end, most people end up enjoying it. I get a lot of thank yous for just doing it and putting it out there.
So you went into this being told by someone who would know that obtaining the square footage might be the most difficult part, but it sounds like that came together pretty quickly.
Well, I wouldn't say it came together quickly, but it did come together kind of magically, and in a way I think it reflects the support of the Fayetteville community for art, and especially public art and street art. Just, you know, people understand that free art is accessible to everyone. There's no barriers. And street art especially, you know, you can enjoy it at any time of the day or night, you know, with a large group of people or individually. And it was really just a matter of my partner Ludi and I, we drove around for about a couple weeks when we were first envisioning a street art festival here, and just looked at walls and said, oh, that's a good one. Write that down. And then that's, you know, and we just went around and thought, well, let's see where, you know, murals would be good. And then we just started contacting the business owners, and we're really quite surprised that so many of them were on board. And it took a while. It took us about 3 months to gather nine locations. And, you know, a lot of it, I will say, though, the level of artists that we had committed to Sprayetteville, Jason, Octavio, Matt Miller, Tiger Sasha, Tommy Tropical, when the building owners heard that these were the artists that were going to be doing murals on their buildings, they were really excited.
So Sprayetteville 2021, that going to happen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've got some great plans for Sprayetteville 2021. We're not announcing anything right now or a date. We're hoping maybe in the spring, so we don't have to put people up on buildings in the heat of the summer. But yeah, some really great great new ideas, collaborations with First Thursday, with Experience Fayetteville, who was also a tremendous help in helping us publicize and promote this year's Sprayetteville. Just some new ideas. There'll be probably a few more, hopefully maybe 15 to 20.
Wow.
Next year. We don't want it to grow too big, too fast, but we do want to, you know, keep throwing paint around Fayetteville and making it, you know, enjoyable and fun for everybody.
Renaga Farbiage is a co-founder of Sprayetteville. He's also a co-owner of a sponsoring business of the festival, American Shaman Kava Bar. And Jason Jones is one of the 11 artists who participated in the 2020 Sprayetteville Street Art Festival. You can find a map and more information about the artists at sprayettevillestreetart.com. We're going to further explore murals, public art, and the artists who created them in the coming weeks on Ozarks at Large, so stay tuned. Raven Cook continues to bring us editions of Reflections in Black, and from her home studio, she's with us again this Wednesday.
This is Reflections in Black, and I'm your host, Raven Cook. Reflections in Black is a segment dedicated to exploring the legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. Reflections in Black also provides resources for understanding and hope for all people. For the next few episodes, I will spend time introducing you to books that I see as essential to anti-racist education. This week, the legendary James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. My first encounter with this text came during the heavy summer where Black Americans dealt with the murders of the Charleston Nine in South Carolina. I struggled to put into language how I felt knowing the horrific way the parishioners of this historic church were taken from all those they loved and who loved them. I ran to the library and ran my fingers through the shelves, where I found a small book tucked away. I sat down and read the book in one sitting. Through this writing, I found an understanding voice, and I felt like I was reading something necessary to my consciousness as a Black woman in America. James Baldwin titles his text after a biblical account in the Bible, where God made Noah, the creator of the ark, a promise to never flood the earth with water again. Throughout African American history, biblical accounts would be turned into song, much like this account, which is a part of the song, "O Mary, Don't You Weep," by the Fisk Jubilee Singers. Much like his predecessor, Dr. Du Bois, James Baldwin uniquely grounds his work in the cadence of the church, managing to be of it, yet not in it. The book is comprised of two important writings that lay the groundwork for writers to come, while echoing writers who have been. The first, eloquently titled "My Dungeon Shook" from the poet Homer, is a writing composed as a letter to his nephew, who shared his name, James. The time period which he is writing happens to be the 100th anniversary of emancipation in 1963. In the first sentences, we see a writer grappling with how to begin explaining the complexity of race to his young namesake, a reality faced by many adult Black Americans through time. Connecting the impoverished conditions of figures from literary works like Dickens to the emphasis on existence like Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, Baldwin reiterates the complexity of living in a society tormented by racism and disproportionate power. Baldwin writes, "This innocent country set you down in a ghetto in which, in fact, it intended that you should perish. Let me spell out precisely what I mean by that, for the heart of the matter is here, and the root of my dispute with my country. You were born where you were born and faced the future that you faced because you were Black, and for no other reason. The limits of your ambition were thus expected to be set forever. You were born into a society which spelled out with brutal clarity and in as many ways as possible that you are a worthless human being. You were not expected to aspire to excellence. You were expected to make peace with mediocrity." Baldwin asked of his nephew to digest some hard truths. However, he also tries to explain why these harsh things exist, saying, "Please try to be clear, dear James. Through the storm which rages about your youthful head today, about the reality which lies behind the words acceptance and integration. There is no reason for you to try to become like white people, and there is no basis whatever for their impertinent assumption that they must accept you. The really terrible thing, old buddy, is that you must accept them. And I mean that very seriously. You must accept them and accept them with love. For these innocent people have no other hope. They are, in effect, still trapped in a history which they do not understand. And until they understand it, they cannot be released from it." In the final chapter of the text, James Baldwin writes from the recesses of his mind, beginning with questions to God and considerations of the church and other movements, and leaders of the day like El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz or Minister Malcolm X. James Baldwin continues the text with important considerations on the challenges to race, writing, "White Americans find it as difficult as white people elsewhere to divest themselves of the notion that they are in possession of some intrinsic value that Black people need or want. And this assumption, which, for example, makes the solution of the Negro problem depend on the speed with which Negroes accept and adopt white standards, is revealed in all kinds of striking ways. from Bobby Kennedy's assurance that a Negro can become president in 40 years to the unfortunate tone of warm congratulation with which so many liberals address their Negro equals. It is the Negro, of course, who is presumed to have become equal, an achievement that not only proves the comforting fact that perseverance has no color, but also overwhelmingly corroborates the white man's sense of his own value. The book nears conclusion with a quote from Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois's Souls of Black Folk. Baldwin writes, "The problem of the 20th century," wrote W.E.B. Du Bois around 60 years ago, "is the problem of the color line, a fearful and delicate problem which comprises when it does not corrupt all the American efforts to build a better world here, there, or anywhere." The final message from James Baldwin is why I have selected this text, The Fire Next Time, and encourage you to take heed of Baldwin's words, where he writes, "If we, and now I mean the relatively conscious whites and the relatively conscious blacks, who must, like lovers, insist on or create the consciousness of the others, do not falter in our duty now, we may be able, handful that we are, to end the racial nightmare and achieve our country and change the history of the world. If we do not now dare everything, the fulfillment of that prophecy recreated from the Bible in song by a slave is upon us. God gave Noah the rainbow sign. No more water, fire next time."
Reflections in Black is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. You can hear weekly segments on Ozarks at Large, and you can find past editions at KUAF.com. Just search Reflections in Black.
This is Ozarks at Large. Community Blood Center of the Ozarks, the sole supplier of blood and plasma to patients at more than 40 area healthcare facilities, is making a plea for anyone who is eligible to donate blood to do so. Donors who give at a CBCO donor center or mobile blood drive will receive a $5 gift card redeemable through the LifePoints local online store and a t-shirt. To find a listing of blood drives or to schedule an appointment, cbco.org. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, a new initiative is connecting displaced hospitality workers with nonprofits providing hunger relief. We'll learn much more about Get Shift Done, plus a report on the increase in COVID-19 cases in Sebastian County, this week's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report, and more. We'll keep you connected with where you live on Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF.
For the Central Arkansas Library System, I'm Mark Chris with an Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute. Fayetteville was home to the first degree-conferring college chartered by the state. Englishman Robert Graham emigrated to the U.S. and after attending a Disciples of Christ college in Virginia, became a missionary for the faith. He organized a Disciples congregation in Fayetteville in 1848 and became its pastor, and in 1851 he bought 10 acres on what is now College Avenue to hold a college. On December 14, 1852, the state legislature passed an act letting Arkansas College confer the degree of doctor and other academical degrees. It awarded its first 7 bachelor's degrees in 1854. Arkansas College attracted students from Arkansas, Missouri, Texas, and the Indian Territory, and enrolled around 200 students per year at its height. When Arkansas seceded from the Union in 1861, the college's students withdrew to serve in the Confederate Army. The Union sympathies of Arkansas College's founders led rebel troops to burn the college down on March 4, 1862. To learn more, visit encyclopediaofarkansas.net.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Hinesville. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large, a production of 91.3 KUAF. A couple of other notes before we go. The Fayetteville Public Schools meal service for children is being extended through August 11th. 5 breakfasts and 5 lunches available each Tuesday for anyone 18 years of age or younger, and that's every Tuesday through the 11th of this month. Meals will continue to be prepackaged to last up to 7 days and therefore should be consumed within 7 days. Pickup locations include Asbell School, Butterfield School, and Happy Hollow Elementary School, plus Owl Creek and the FPS food truck that parks at the Fayetteville Public Library on Tuesdays. Families needing assistance with meals may visit partner agencies, including LifeSource at lifesourceinternational.org and the Salvation Army at nwasalvationarmy.org. Contributors to tonight's edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, Raven Cook, Zuzana Sitek provided sound and information about rent assistance for residents of Fayetteville. Timothy Dennis produced tonight's Reflections in Black. He also engineered and mastered tonight's edition of Ozarks at Large. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It is performed and written by Daryl Sean. You can find Daryl Sean online, and his most recent CD is titled Safe in Sound. We will have a new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon. And you can always find us online at ozarksatlarge.com. At our website, we have full editions of past shows. You can also find individuals and stories, and we provide links so you can share those individual stories as well. You can follow us on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our free podcast. It's available through all the major podcast distributors, including Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Apple Podcasts. And one more push for the free Ozarks at Large newsletter. You can subscribe for free at KUAF.com, and when you do that, you can receive every Monday through Friday in your email inbox a list of the stories that were on that day's program with links so you can listen to them. It's absolutely free, delivered to your email inbox every day. And finally, you can ask your smart speaker to play Ozarks at Large to hear the most recent edition of our program. We try to make it as easy as possible to stay up with what's happening in our world through Ozarks at Large. Back tomorrow at noon from the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in downtown Fayetteville, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for making us part of your Wednesday. We do appreciate it. Please stay well, wear your mask, wash your hands, and we will talk to you again tomorrow at noon. Thanks.